At the easternmost edge of Long Island lies Montauk Point, a scenic landmark with beautiful views along the New York coast. Just to the west of this, however, lies the abandoned Montauk Air Force Base on the grounds of Old Fort Hero. It is said, after the government ceased operations there, a group of independently funded researchers began conducting experiments ranging from psychological warfare to time travel, using unsuspecting members of the military and even children. This project came to a disastrous end when the scientists ripped a hole in space-time to 1943, and their test subject conjured an enormous monster so violent and destructive, the entire base fled for their lives. You are listening to Creep It Real, and today we are covering the Montauk Project.
Creep It Real is a weekly podcast where we present our theories of the subjects we cover based on our interest and research. Some material may be graphic and disturbing, so proceed with caution.
All right, everybody. We are back. Shai's back this week.
Hi.
Thank goodness.
We have noticed a lot of new listeners in the past week, and we really appreciate any sort of word of mouth or exposure for the podcast. And it's really exciting every time Ashley checks the status, and then she'll send me over screenshots. So it's been something that keeps us jazzed up and ready to make more podcasts for y'all.
Big time. Yeah, we definitely appreciate all the new listeners. Thanks, guys. And hearing from you is pretty exciting, too, so keep that up. I'm a big nerd, so just keep that in mind. All right, this week, we are discussing something that, true or not, it's a little mind-blowing. Like, the whole thing is just kind of giving me a major puzzled brain. Like, it's just mixed up, man.
Yeah, we're not here to tell you that this was something that actually happened or try to convince you that the story is legitimate, but it is very interesting to see how far the human mind does go when it kind of gets into these wormholes, so to speak.
And also, I also am not here to tell you it's not true either. So that's, let me just say that. Like, I'm a skeptic, but there are things that kind of, you know, sometimes it's just so bizarre that there might be some truth to it.
Truth is stranger than fiction most of the time.
So in case you didn't see our little teaser post, we are discussing the Montauk Project and a little bit of the background of like the Philadelphia experiment, but our main topic today is going to be the Montauk Project and everything that went on at the Montauk Air Force Base in New York.
Yep.
So it is like, and like, this has opened up in my head at least just all of these different rabbit holes of possibilities, and just really, like I said, right now I'm like almost in a state of, I can't talk because my mind has been blown for a continuous amount of days, the past week, I guess you would say.
I don't know why, but this just popped in my head. I don't know if any of you have seen the movie Gentleman Bronco, but when we talk about like things that happened during the Montauk Project and Philadelphia experiment, it just kind of reminds me of when they're like riding their battle stags and blasting lasers at each other in that movie Gentleman Bronco. If you haven't seen it, you really should.
I haven't seen it.
It's hilarious.
I do love Jemaine Clement.
Yeah, yeah.
So I read this subject today. I read a book from Preston Nichols called The Montauk Project Experiments in Time, and that's where I got a lot of my information. And so a lot of what we talk about today is going to be his reference to those situations because he supposedly was there. So in the early 70s, this Preston Nichols, who was a specialist in electromagnetic phenomena, he worked for a defense contractor, but at the same time, he had also gotten a grant to study if mental telepathy was an actual legitimate occurrence or not. And in his studies, he found that telepathic waves were like radio waves in some ways, but they did not have all the normal wave functions. So you could actually study them visually. And in his studies, he kind of gathered about five or six psychics who he felt had some credibility and worked with them on numerous occasions. And he found that they all got blocked around the same time every single day. And it was by an on-air signal that was between 410 and 420 megahertz, which he pinpointed to the Montauk Air Force Base. So he went up to this Air Force Base and he noticed that they were using an old World War II defense system SAGE radar that was on Montauk Point. It was totally antiquated. and he did not know any reason why they would be using such an out-of-date radar. So he went to the base. It was active at the time. He asked about it, but since it was active, they really could not give him any information. And that gave him some kind of, I guess, like a little bug up his butt that he wanted to go study this Air Force base a little more to figure out why they were using this giant outdated radar.
So 10 years later, Frank called him up and told him that the Air Force base had actually been shut down, and he was like, hey, do you want to go explore it? Because that's what friends do.
Sounds like fun.
So when they arrived, the base was completely abandoned. Gates and doors were open, windows were left open, and it wasn't like a typical military shutdown, like you would normally think, you know, keep out signs and
locked doors.
So a homeless man was actually living in one of the buildings that they came across, and he told him that he had worked on the base and that a giant creature had shown up one day and caused everyone to flee in like this panic. There were also irregular weather patterns around the base, and they were performing mind control experiments. And then he said that he recognized Nicholas and said that he was his boss. So, dun, dun, dun. So, over the course of the next few months, Preston Nichols, he had a slew of people confront him regarding being their boss at the Montauk Project and have had detailed technical knowledge of things going on there.
So that seems a little wackadoo, you know? I mean, this is like, these start to be the times where I think an extremely skeptical person that doesn't really want to even give any of these types of situations consideration after they hear something like that. Like, that's the kind of, that's the kind of thing that like kind of would drive somebody away. But I implore you to continue to listen because it's definitely interesting. There's, you know, science that goes on here that I feel like kind of explains that some things are legitimate here. It's just a matter of how far did this really go?
Yeah. He began to investigate as much as he could about the base and what had actually went on there. And he ended up asking the locals about strange events in the area. And six people said that it had snowed in mid-August. Mm. So
that's pretty weird.
Yeah. And what's really weird is like the weather this year. I mean, there's snow in Las Vegas and stuff. So like how much this type of thing like recycle itself? Yeah. You know what I mean?
Who knows?
So others said that hurricane winds, storms, hail, lightning had all taken place throughout the years without prior meteorological evidence to predict them. So no almanac records or, like we said, reoccurring type issues in this area had happened.
Yeah, like this was not a typical event that had gone on before, and like the meteorologists couldn't predict this, you know, days in advance or hours in advance.
Yeah.
Oh, sure. So he then spoke to the police chief, who said that there were animals that would come into town en masse, sometimes crashing into the windows. And it was a small town with infrequent incidences of crime, yet they would have like these 2-hour periods straight where crimes were just being committed nonstop, and then they would completely stop, and then again would occur for another 2 hours straight. And that kind of thing went on for the entirety of this 10 years that this project went on at the Air Force Base. He also reported that teens would suddenly group together in these large groups for 2 hours, and then after the 2-hour mark, they would suddenly completely break up and go their separate ways without any reason or seemingly any reason at all. So that, you know, those were the weird occurrences, and that's given to him from a police officer. So you have to think there's some credibility there, and that a police officer isn't going to be known for spreading these insane rumors about weird occurrences in his town where he is the sheriff. Mm-hmm. That, you know, I mean, whenever like somebody like that gives you a testimony of that nature, I think have to like look at it like there's some credibility there. So one day, a man named Duncan showed up to Nichols' lab, and he quickly ingrained himself into the research group. He was very knowledgeable about what they were doing with the engineering, and he was just very helpful. But Nichols took to him really quickly and just kind of ingrained him in the group. And he took him to Montauk, where he said Duncan immediately began to identify buildings and details about the buildings and just like knew all this information that he wouldn't have thought he would know. And they entered the building with the transmitter, and Duncan went into a trance-like state and began to spit out all this information about the Montauk Project that he had previously not remembered, supposedly. He said, so here's where you're really going to be like, what? So he said that he was programmed to come and befriend Preston Nichols to then kill him and blow up his lab and essentially destroy all of the evidence and research that he had been doing.
So he's almost like a sleeper agent.
Yes.
Because it gets into like there's like a code word and anyway, it's essentially what it is.
Totally. And to be honest with you, I don't know a lot about that. It's funny because I had a friend just mention to me the other day about how she had read something about how Lee Harvey Oswald had been a sleeper agent who was in, I think, MK Ultra, and they think that he was a sleeper agent and ended up killing the president without even really meaning to. So he was just right. like a pawn in the game of whoever, I guess, was controlling his mind. And so that's essentially what this guy Duncan was saying that he had come to do, was kill Nichols and destroy all his research. So Duncan also said that he and his brother Edward were members of the USS Eldridge on the crew of that ship on the Philadelphia experiment, which that's quite a coincidence. And I think I'm going to have Shai kind of talk about the Philadelphia experiment a little bit.
So the Philadelphia experiment is honestly kind of cool in theory, because allegedly it was a military experiment that was supposed to have carried out by the U.S. Navy at a Philadelphia naval shipyard in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, sometime around October 28th, 1943. They wanted to take the Navy destroyer escort, the USS Eldridge, and they wanted to have it kind of disappear or become cloaked so that, you know, enemy ships could not see it. And the way they wanted to do this was to use magnets and kind of bend light around it so that it didn't literally disappear, but it couldn't be seen by others. Well, what they claim happened is that down the line, somehow they ended up creating like almost a wormhole and portal, and the ship ended up like 400 miles away, which had these catastrophic effects on the crew. They say like they found the crew members kind of melded into the ship, where they would find like arms hanging out of the wall or men that were still alive that were kind of like cast into the actual ship.
Yeah, like halfsies.
Yeah, exactly. And a lot of the crew members said to have suffered like schizophrenia and all these health issues.
I do remember at least this much, that it mentally destroyed most of them. Like they were crazy after that.
Whether or not this happened, a lot of the people came out of it with some like severe mental issues. But the U.S. Navy actually maintains that no experiment whatsoever was conducted, and that it was just like this elaborate hoax.
Yeah, I mean, if it did happen, of course they say that, but also is pretty bizarre for sure.
Yeah, so it gets into like this huge ordeal where like an astronomer and UFO buff named Morris K. Jessup, he wrote a couple books called The Case for the UFO about unidentified flying objects and how they actually fly, and that they use magnets to create propulsion because, you know, you have like the Earth has like natural magnetic force. So if you take a ship and you have like the opposite magnetic push-pull, it's going to make it fly up or whatever. But he was kind of seen as like a wackadoo, so.
Which, you know, could be that he's a wackadoo. It also could be a good way to discredit people that have, you know, some advanced theories. I'm just playing devil's advocate here.
I mean, they're saying, you know, like when the ship was transported or teleported to New York, that they had encountered aliens and they were kind of like in another dimension and they had contact with like these other beings, and it's just.
Oh my, I didn't hear all that. Yeah. I didn't hear all that part, but that's quite elaborate.
Yeah.
Okay. Anything else?
I mean,
good. Go
well,
on there.
Anyway, long story short, the Navy supposedly was trying out this experiment, which would have been good in theory for battle, but it went totally wrong, and they ended up creating this other dimension wormhole.
Yeah.
So good job, guys.
So this Duncan fella, he is now saying he has come from this Philadelphia experiment. So interesting. And that's going to actually tie in later too. So we shall see how this unfolds.
Oh, and I wanted to say, listen carefully to this, you guys, because there is a surprise. And if you can tie this into a popular show, you win a prize.
Oh, yeah. We won't tell you what it is, but it's really good.
Mystery prize.
Okay, so while Nichols had been on with his friend searching around on the base, he had found various orders to different military personnel scattered around the base. And he took photos of them because he didn't want to take anything, I guess. But he took photos of them so that he could show these to other people later and see if these were legit. And he ended up getting in contact with the senator that was formerly in the Air Force, who he thought he might have some connections that would enable him to get a little more information about what was going on there. So the senator took it upon himself to investigate into the matter. And he found that the military technicians who had been on those orders that Preston Nichols had found on the base actually did exist and had been assigned to the Montauk Air Force Base. The strange thing about that was that the base had been decommissioned, derelict, and mothballed since 1969. So at this time, it had been closed already, officially closed, not running where the military would be working on it. So the question you got to ask yourself is, why was there Air Force personnel working on a derelict base? And where did the money come from to fund the work that was being done on this base if it wasn't actually officially open for military use? The property of Camp Hero, which is the base, and Montauk were listed as derelict, and the property was listed as held by the General Services Administration since 1970. So just closed, totally not open for business in any way, but it was still held by the GSA. Oddly enough, though, the senator was not greeted with enthusiastic cooperation, and he told Preston Nichols not to speak publicly about his investigation or he could jeopardize it. So he was kind of trying to do this on the down low because nobody was really that excited to see him asking questions and trying to find more information out about what was going on there. And when his investigation was complete, he found that there was no trace of government funding, there were no appropriations, no oversight committee, and there were zero records of any payments being made in the entire time that place had been open. So at that point, what went on that base was a complete mystery still. And sounds sketchy.
Very sketchy. Yeah. And so Preston, he was still working with the defense contractor after the beginning of the investigation into Camp Hero and the Montauk project. He began to feel serious anxiety around certain areas in the building where he worked. And that kind of goes into like when you get those weird gut feelings when you're in a place, you know, you really shouldn't be. No, I think it happens to everybody, you know, at some point in their life.
Also, think about the Dyatlov. I'm bringing these guys up every episode, it seems, but think about the Dyatlov people and how we learned that how certain infrasonic waves can make you feel extreme unease or discomfort. And to me, like, this all kind of ties into that as well. So anyway.
So, I mean, if they were really messing around with, like, magnets and electricity and all that stuff, then this is a very, you know, real possibility that these feelings were legitimate, but were for coming from, like, a scientific explanation.
Yeah.
He asked around about a particular locker room and found that only 10 people in the company had clearance to enter this room. After investigating it a little bit more, he found two people who had gotten clearance to enter the room, but they told him they couldn't say anything to him pertaining to the room, and the conversation just ended there. And then 2 weeks later, he says, the room's door was suddenly open and had been completely cleared of any and everything that had been in there.
So he asked a couple questions and the room's cleared completely.
Yeah. He was actually able to go into the room now and he found there were dirt markings on the ground, four round structures, what he presumed were coil structures, and a console. It had a huge power line, and there was an elevator at the back of the room that only had two buttons, main and subfloor, and a numbered keypad. So he pushed the button for the subfloor down, but the elevator would only go as far before prompting him to enter the proper code into the keypad. So after no code was entered, an alarm went off. Within 30 seconds, the security was alerted.
So then following this, Nichols started to have like these strange experiences where he would be sitting at his desk and all of a sudden he would realize that he had a Band-Aid on his hand when he didn't have one on his hand before, like 15 minutes before. He was having these weird flashback memories of moving equipment, but he didn't actually remember doing it. And he just kept getting these weird Band-Aids on his arm and on his hand. And like he would say, I would look down and it would be there all of a sudden. And it wasn't there just 5 minutes before. So he went to the company nurse and he asked her if she was giving him these Band-Aids in some way like he didn't remember. And she had no memory of giving these Band-Aids to him. And he came again and asked her a second time. And after that time, she actually told the security, and security came and asked him why he was going to the nurse so often. So after that point, when the security came and talked to him because of the Band-Aid situation, which seems kind of silly, he decided to drop it as far as the Band-Aid situation is concerned and not try to like investigate that any further. So one day he walked into this high security area and he didn't have clearance to enter, but he kind of just went down there on a whim and thought, okay, I'm going to hand the security guy my badge and see what happens. And the security guy took his badge and gave him a new one. And and told him that he was free to go inside. So he said he just followed his intuition and walked back to a mahogany office where he found a nameplate that had his name on it, and it said he was the assistant project director. So that was a little surprising, I would say. And he said he sat down and like for 6 hours, he just went through all the paperwork and documents that were in the desk and just trying to like soak it all up. Like he spent as much time as he could so that he could try to remember as much as he could, because he knew that he wasn't going to be able to take it with him. And a few weeks later, he returned to that lower floor area where he had found the office. And again, he handed the security guard his badge, but he was then not granted entry. And a project director came down to speak to him and asked him why he was trying to get into the office or the lower office. And he said, well, I have an office down here. And the man was like, no, you don't. He was like, I do. And he said, okay, well, show me that office. So he like walked him over to where his office had been, and it had been completely cleared. The room was empty and there was no sign of the previous office that had been there whenever he was there a few weeks later. So is this, you know, like schizophrenia or is this... Is this something that is more maybe insidious, or, you know, someone is actually trying to get him to not remember certain things? I don't know. I can't tell you for sure.
Well, you got to think, like, are these people purposely trying to make him feel crazy? Like maybe he's the one
right, going
insane? And
you have to give that some sort of thought that, yes, trying to discredit somebody by making them appear to be crazy is a legitimate form of discrediting people. It happens.
Yeah. So he was pulled aside and told if he breathed a word about any of this, he would be locked away in jail and the key would be thrown away. So basically, he would be like wiped off the face of the earth.
Yeah.
At this point, Nichols was positive he was living two separate existences.
So, okay.
Ooh, spooky. One day he was installing a delta antenna on his lab and began to remember things that he had been blocked from his mind. In July 1990, he was laid off from the defense contractor. Just prior to this, all of his closest contacts had also been terminated.
They were kind of like clearing this place out of some of these people that seem to have...
Yeah.
Yeah.
They were cleaning house, essentially, to get rid of these people. He worked for this company for about 2 decades, and then suddenly all his links and his friends had, and ultimately info sources, were severed. So... this is the only life you know. This is what you've been doing for 2 decades, and then all of a sudden it's like gone.
Yeah.
What do you do with that? How do you feel?
Yeah, and you like don't even really know what the heck was going on to begin with, you know? It sounds like
right.
It sounds like all of a sudden it's like you're starting to realize that what you thought you have been doing, you weren't doing necessarily that and that alone. And then soon after you start trying to investigate that and not just, I guess, be the complicit little sleeper agent then in your own way, then you're fired, and so is everybody that you seem to have created relationships with for 20 years. So it would be interesting to kind of see the if there's actually a record of any of it, you know, of any of that part of it. But
right.
Yeah.
Like all the employees, and then like, you know, because when you fire people or terminate them, there's a process and there's documentation.
But you probably can't get private employment information, because this was with the defense contractor who apparently was working with the Montauk project, which was being funded by who knows who. It could be aliens for all we know. Okay, so like Shai said, he started working with these Delta T antennas and it started to do stuff with his mind. And a Delta T antenna is an octahedral antenna that can shift time zones and are designed to bend time. Delta T actually stands for delta time, which delta is used in science to show a change in something. And then T being time, changes in time, this is a change in time. Just to kind of give you a little background on delta antennas, they'll come into play many times in the story. So in the 1940s, the government began weather control programs under the code name Phoenix. The information and technology for these programs came from Dr. Wilhelm Reich, an Austrian scientist who worked with Sigmund Freud and Carl Jung. And the FDA actually supervised a massive book burning of all of his material and destroyed most of his lab equipment from these weather control programs. So Reich was known for orgone energy, or orgasmic or life energy, and his experiments revealed that orgone energy was extremely different than ordinary electromagnetic energy, and he was able to prove this energy existed in the lab. So it was written about in various psychiatric and medical journals of the time. He associated orgone energy with cosmic energy energy and the Newtonian concept of the ether. And none of these views at the time were supported from conservative scientists. Common modern research shows that vacuum space contains complex properties that are dynamic in nature and kind of support his theories of orgone energy and the concept of the ether. And a lot of this, I know you're going to be like, what are you saying? I kind of feel the same way, but it is important and it does help kind of give you a better picture of what was going on in these tests. And what was going on in these tests is extremely interesting. And I don't just want to tell you what they were doing. We want to tell you how they were doing it and how they could explain it scientifically. So the researchers found that there were practical uses for this orgone energy, like weather manipulation. And they found that violent storms accumulate dead orgone, or DOR, energy. And the accumulation of this dead energy is energy on a descending spiral. It is found in biological organisms and empty regions of the environment as well. And an example of this orgone energy, so say a go-getter who is like happy and always trying to make a move in the positive direction has plenty of orgone energy, whereas like somebody who's like complaining hypochondriac that wants to die has dead orgone energy. So they soon found that the more dead orgone energy that a storm system contained, the more violent the storm system would be. They experimented with many DOR busting forms and came up with a simple electromagnetic method to reduce violent storms. And in the 1940s, Reich contacted the government and told them about this weather manipulating technology.
And even today, people are like, you know, there's some people out there that are convinced that the government actually controls our weather and all these catastrophic natural disasters are man-made.
I mean, I think that there has to be some, if this was going on back then, there has to be some advances in this by somebody. Now, we'll see in a minute, like the government stopped doing this officially because of legal reasons, but you know,
well, duh.
Yeah, but like, you know, as we were going to see in this story, just in this story alone, that there are definitely defense contractor, non-government sanctioned companies with technology and money that I'm sure are able to manipulate things and conduct experiments and research that is not approved by the government. So anyway, back in the 1920s, the government was sending these little devices up into the sky that would record temperature, humidity, and pressure, and they would, a balloon would pop and it would come back down to Earth, and they were trying to record information about the weather, but it took so long. And so the government's tech team merged with Reich's discoveries. They combined this with Reich's dead orgone energy busting device and called it the radio sonde, and they began to conduct experiments with it. And witnesses of these experiments saw approaching storm systems split up and go around the test site on Long Island. And that's just to like give you an idea of what they could do. So it was able to break up a storm system and make it completely go around the test site. They kept this technology really secret. They sent certain things up into the atmosphere, like these little devices, but they didn't want anyone to be able to really do anything with them whenever they fell back down to Earth. So they lied about what they did and how long they were able to be in function. And obviously there was like something with this DOR busting technology that the government really didn't want anyone else to, just normal citizens, to be privy to. So they were trying to hide something. Now, what it was, I'm not sure, but obviously it's some sort of technology. So these little devices would like transmit out certain waves and it would end up breaking up a storm, or they could also make a storm build up. In addition to breaking up a storm, they could actually intensify them as well. So they were manipulating the weather. And like Shai said earlier, like that is creepy and something that, you know, is that going on now today? Who knows?
Who knows?
Yeah.
So we have this project dubbed Project Rainbow resurfaced in the 1940s under the code name for the operations that brought about the Philadelphia experiment. They were continuing to research into the phenomena encountered on the USS Eldridge, which we mentioned earlier about the transporting and whatnot.
Yeah.
Their concern was the electromagnetic bottle technology, which eventually resulted in the modern stealth fighter craft. So we think about the stealth fighter and how, I mean, it was almost like an accident that this technology came about and we were able to produce these types of crafts.
Yeah. And okay, so obviously we have modern technology that we see as a result of these projects. So to me, at least, and I think Shai agrees, I always say that, though it does give it some validity. You know, there, it gives some of the story of some validity because we have some actual tangible proof that something like that stealth technology resulted from the test that they were doing, similar to the Philadelphia project. It was kind of like a precursor to this stealth technology. So, you know, there is some truth to this stuff, and you can't just totally discount all of it.
So Dr. John von Neumann was hired to find out what went wrong with the human factor in the experiment and why it seemed to gravely affect some of the men aboard the ship. In the early 1950s, the government decided that Project Rainbow and the radio sonde be included under the same umbrella, and the name the Phoenix Project was used for it all. The headquarters were at Brookhaven Labs on Long Island, and Dr. Neumann was also in charge. Neumann was a mathematician, but also became a theoretical physicist noted for advanced concept of space and time. He built the first vacuum tube computer at Princeton and served as head of the Institute for Advanced Study. So kind of a brainiac over here.
Yeah, maybe a little intelligent.
Right. His background in math gave him enough theory to communicate with Einstein, and he could serve as a go-between for him and the engineers. He soon learned that in order to begin to understand what went wrong with the Philadelphia project, he had to understand the metaphysical side of man. The rainbow technology had dissolved physical and biological structures of human beings. People were stuck in the bulkheads and changed beyond recognition in some cases. But the esoteric workings of the mind were what was affected first in each case.
Right. It affected their mind first and foremost before anything else.
Yeah, because as we said, you know, a lot of them suffered from mental issues afterwards. Neumann had spent 10 years working out why humans had troubles with electromagnetic fields that shifted them through different places and times. Which, if you've ever watched shows on like the human brain, they always say that like your brain is just a bunch of electromagnetic pulses and electricity circuits and whatnot. So it would kind of make sense to think that something like this would have such a dire effect on your brain and kind of alter its way of working.
Right.
What he found was that humans were born with a time reference point. He says that conception and energy is attached to a timeline, and we all start from this point. Our energy being is separate from our physical body.
So this is where I was like, what? Okay, so our whole reference as a physical or metaphysical being stems from that time reference, which I just mentioned, which reads within the electromagnetic background of our planet. So it is the basic orientation point that you have to the universe and the way it operates. It is what keeps you mentally grounded. So this time reference point is what was thrown off kilter with the crewmen of the USS Eldridge and caused the untold trauma to their brains. The rainbow technology turns on and creates an alternate or artificial reality. So it creates a stealth effect by isolating the ship and the individual beings within the bottle effect. And the beings in this bottle effect are literally, they're removed from space and our universe as we know it, which accounts for the invisibility of the ship and the people. So
if you've ever seen The Matrix, this is kind of what I put two and two together. This is what comes to my mind, which isn't the secret show I was talking about, but
it's just another.
Yeah, just another.
Yeah, so like I think a lot of sci-fi references things that perhaps are not so fictional, but perhaps just are things that we aren't always knowledgeable about or knowledgeable of. Right. So the alternate reality that's created has no time reference because it is not part of our normal time stream. They are entirely out of time. It's like waking up and not knowing where you are at all and not being able to figure it out either. The Phoenix Project was faced with solving the problem of bringing the humans into the bottle and also out again while simultaneously connecting them to a real time reference, which is Earth, while they're in that no time zone. So what in the heck are you talking about? What are you saying right now? So
it's very easy to kind of get lost on this.
But I do think it's important to talk about. So when the people are in the bottle or the alternate reality, they had to be supplied with something that would give them a time reference instead of just like free floating with no time at all. So I think that makes sense to you. The scientists solved this by feeding into the bottle the natural backgrounds of Earth, or at least enough to convince the people inside of this continuous time stream of a time reference. Okay, so they just needed to feed something into into that bottle with them that would make them feel like they were still on Earth.
So kind of like the Matrix when they program.
Yeah.
Backgrounds and cities and people. And
that's so true, because we will talk about it. Like, they do have to create programs in order to get these people in a place where they're not going to absolutely lose their minds whenever they have to go through these experiences. So, I mean, it all is down to the computer programming. Yeah. So it was necessary to set a phony stage to feel some degree of normalcy, like we said. So to do this, the computer had to calculate time references of specific people and replicate those while passing them through the electromagnetic bottle. So the people inside the bottle, they would be going through zero time or no reality, or at least a disoriented reality at best. But the computer had to generate an electromagnetic background or phony stage that the physical being would sync with as well. And I'm pretty sure you saying that made it make so much more sense to me and other people probably as
right,
well.
Because when you think about the movie, they're able to manifest things in the alternate reality because it's like a blank canvas almost for anything you want. You know
right.
what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, the movie, the creepy guy talks about the steak and how he knows it's not real, but he can manifest the taste and how he wants it to be. So, yeah. I don't know if that helps.
Yeah, I think it does. I think it's really helpful, actually. So eventually Congress disbanded the Phoenix Project. I'm sure it was just getting a little beyond them, but the group at Brookhaven had already built this entire kingdom around the project. They had Reichian and stealth technology, and they weren't about to just stop because Congress told them that they weren't funding them anymore. So the people at Brookhaven went to the military and they informed them about the new technology that they were working on that could make the enemy surrender without a war simply by flipping a switch, which I'm sure sounded pretty appealing.
Yeah.
Obviously, the military was enthusiastic and wanted to cooperate, which is a big shocker, I'm sure. And then an even bigger plus for them, probably at the outset, at least they thought it was they were told they didn't need to get involved in any financing of the project because it was covered by the group at Brookhaven, which, I say, because I'm like, what is the, who's the financier of this little project? But the people at Brookhaven, they needed a place to properly experiment in seclusion, and they needed certain equipment and personnel from the military, which I guess they were happy to oblige at this point, and they gave them a list of the technology that they required. One of the biggest things that they needed was an old Sage radar. They required a huge radio sonde that could operate around 425 to 450 megahertz. From earlier research, this was known to be the megahertz range for getting into the human consciousness. And I think we can all remember that we just spoke of a giant antiquated antenna that was on the top of the Montauk Air Force Base, and that was the perfect thing for this Brookhaven group. So it was exactly what they needed. They had a whole Air Force Base where they had the antenna and the seclusion that they needed, and now they are, you know, they pretty much have the military there to do their bidding.
So the name of this new project became Project Phoenix 2 by officials. It was
colloquially
named by the author and others involved as the Montauk Project.
The Montauk Project.
Up until the move to Montauk, Congress had been informed about what occurred with these scientists' research. But at this point, independent people were carrying forward with a project that was denied by Congress and was operating outside of any controls while also using the military. There was zero documented proof of any financing, but sources claim that funding originally came from
The Nazis.
Always the Nazis.
Always.
In 1944, an American troop train went through a French tunnel carrying $10 billion in Nazi gold. The train was dynamited in the tunnel carrying 51 GIs. The gold supposedly ended up at Montauk priced at $20 an ounce, $200 billion in today's currency, which financed the project for years. When the money finally ran out, it was then financed by the Krupp family, who controlled the ITT Corporation. The Krupps were the owners of the German munitions factories for World War I and World War II. After being found guilty of war crimes and complicity with Hitler, the head of the family was paroled from his light prison sentence and allowed to continue his notorious arms dealings.
So this kind of shady Krupp character, who was notorious for arms dealings and war crimes, times, is supposedly the financer of the Montauk Project after the Nazi gold ran out, supposedly. So basically, just basically another Nazi.
Which just goes to show you what money can do for you.
Yeah, I feel like we're seeing that more and more every day, but continue.
Yep. So in the late 70s and 71, the Montauk Air Force Base Raider Battalion was actively being reestablished. They had to get staff and equipment working set up and working at the new research facility, which took about 1 year. The Montauk Project was underway by late 1971. The staff at the base was a mixture of military employees, government employees, and personnel of various corporations. Preston Nichols was one of the latter and came on the project in 1973. Inside the building was a chair in a shielded room. They experimented with running transmitters at different pulse widths, rates, and frequencies. And here's kind of interesting, because when you watch like sci-fi movies and things of that nature, they have like this common thing, how they all have like this chair, whether it's a space chair in a spaceship, or a chair that you sit in. Like, they're talking about like Stargate, you know, the show Stargate. There's like a chair. I haven't ever watched those shows because I'm not a nerd, but just kidding, if you like Stargate, I'm sorry. There's like a chair and it like transports you to your Stargate or whatever, and so just kind of like these weird coincidences.
Yeah, just like how we were talking about how the...
The Matrix, again.
Yeah. Oh, and the Matrix has a chair.
The Matrix. They all sit in chairs when they go in and out of the Matrix because they have to be plugged in. So.
Right.
So they tried everything they could think of, just good old empirical experimentation. Different changes and combinations could make a person sleep, cry, laugh, be agitated, etc., which goes back again to the Dyatlov, where frequencies had major effects on people's moods.
For sure.
I don't know if I mentioned it in that episode, but we had a science teacher one time didn't tell us that she had actually a machine in the classroom and had been running it the entire time we were in there on a low frequency, which we couldn't actually hear. But by the end of the class, we all had headaches and felt really agitated and didn't know why. And then she was like, surprise, I've been doing this. And we were all like, thanks a lot, lady.
Thanks.
There were rumors that when the Sage Raider ran, the mood of the entire base was changed. The scientists wanted to see how they could change and train brain waves. This was done by changing repetition rates of the pulse and amplitude in correspondence to different biological functions. This way, a person's thoughts could be controlled. This just made me think of like the Brown Note, when they play like a certain musical note, people poop their pants because it like releases your bowels. I don't know. Maybe it's something like that. Maybe they were just trying to get people to poop their pants.
God. That might have been one of the things that they tried.
Hey, you never know.
Yeah. So using the 425 to 450 megahertz of radio frequency power, it gave them a window into the human mind. So the next step, they wanted to find out what was inside of it. And now the subjects were exposed to strong enough waves to influence their brain waves, but to not do damage to their brain. Now, that being said, if they were exposed over several days in a row, or, you know, for just too long of a period of time, then it did do damage to their brain. And there was that man who we mentioned earlier, Duncan, he actually sustained serious brain and tissue damage, supposedly, because he was the main test subject of this group. He was just like, he had the most consistent and strong, I guess, psychic abilities that they needed, or was able to like tap into his, you know, higher consciousness easier. So they used this guy supposedly like crazy, and he ended up having serious issues with like scar tissue developing in his lungs, and his brain was just kind of fried. When he went to the doctor in 1988, his doctor commented that he had never seen such strange scar tissue that was in Duncan's lungs. The only other time he had seen it was in the service, when someone had gotten in front of a high-powered radar beam, which was exactly what was happening with Duncan.
So beam microwave.
Right. Okay, so yeah. So Duncan got kind of screwed in this whole deal. So at this point in the project, the researchers were interested in monitoring people and starting to change their thoughts and moods. So they were kind of just like getting more and more into furthering this mind investigation research, I guess, or mind control. So they needed test subjects, and they invited a lot of different army units to come and stay at the base for R&R. It was a beautiful location on the coast. There was a huge gymnasium, a bowling alley. There was great food and accommodations. And unbeknownst to the servicemen, they really were being invited so that they could become guinea pigs for these mood control experiments. And they weren't the only guinea pigs, because they also tested it on the townspeople. Civilians in Long Island, New Jersey, upstate New York, and Connecticut were all used as guinea pigs to see how this mood control experiment, how these mood control experiments would affect all these different people. But most of the tests were done on vacationing soldiers, and a huge amount of data was collected from all of these tests. So once they had enough data, they began to make sense out of which functions did what combinations elicited what response, and also were experimenting with frequency hopping, which consisted of kind of randomly shifting their transmitter around to 5 different frequencies. And that's a later key as to how they were able to kind of bend time. So the more and the faster that the frequency hopped, the more psychoactive the results would be. So they just kept kind of honing in on this technology, and their database became very extensive, and it covered an extremely broad range of cause and effect. So they were coming up with a lot of different ways that they could elicit specific responses from their test subjects. It took about to like 4 years of research, and they continued to evolve the technology. And soon they had programs that could change people's moods, that could increase the crime rate. Like we mentioned, the chief of police had mentioned earlier, it could make people agitated, and even animals within the vicinity were programmed to do strange things. I think this all sounds a little familiar. They also started to create programs where they could affect electronics. They ended up doing some tests one day where they were trying to stop all the electronics in a vehicle, or all the electric functions of a vehicle. And like, so some military vehicles were just kind of shut down completely, like mid drive.
This would be, yeah, like a war tactic, you know, like point a beam at like their defense vehicles, and then they would just like stop working.
Right, and couldn't do anything with them. So yeah. that would be very helpful. So after several years of this research, they had finally developed a mind control device, and it was their next objective to create the precision technology they needed to be able to use it the way they wanted to. So they needed an amplitron, which is just like this ultra high-powered, high-frequency antenna, and a thyrotron, which is just a, like, regulated frequency hopping source. I don't think we really need to go too much into that, but the frequency hopping is what made mind control and time bending possible, and so they needed these super powerful machines in order to further their research.
I like it. It's kind of strange because around all this time, there were like so many different ways the government was trying to do mind control. Like, again, you know, MK Ultra, Manchurian candidates, they were experimenting a lot with like LSD, that sort of thing. So
yeah,
it's no surprise that they were trying, you know, anything and everything to kind of do this.
Yeah, it does seem like they're just like kind of just throwing in out all the stops here. Like, what?
Yeah.
Everything but the kitchen sink. In the 1950s, the ITT Corporation developed sensor technology that could display what a person was thinking, and they dubbed it the mind reading machine. And it operated on the principle of picking up electromagnetic functions of human beings and then translating that into an understandable form, which I'm like, huh? I don't know how, but okay. It was a chair in which a person would sit. So here's that chair again. There were coils, uh-huh, which served as sensors that were placed around the chair. And there were 3 receivers, 6 channels, and then this Cray-1 computer. So this Cray-1 computer would display what was on a person's mind digitally on the screen. And it's apparently, it's still a mystery as to how this technology was actually developed. It has been suggested that the research was aided by the Sirians, who are an alien race who had come from the star system known as Sirius. This theory has aliens providing a basic design for the humans, and they worked it out from there. Take that how you will. You know, that sounds pretty crazy, but I will say probably stranger things have happened. We'll see.
Well, it's either aliens or Nazis.
Yeah, it's gotta always be one or the other. And you know, the fact that that's always the case, like, that brings some suspicion in my head.
The way it makes me think, it's like you're hooked up to this machine and it's getting these brain waves, and it's almost like a 3D printer.
Yeah.
But it's like a rough sketch of what your brain's output is.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
I mean, I think so.
Like an etch-a-sketch or something.
Yeah.
Because that's how magnets or whatever, yeah, all that
technology. The ultra...
The aliens gave us Etch-A-Sketch.
The ultra-high technology of Etch-A-Sketch.
Yes, Syrian technology. Mm-hmm. There were three sets of coils set up in a pyramid around the chair and another coil around the top of the pyramid to parallel the base coil. The person was placed in the chair inside the field of coils. The three sets of coils were then connected to three different radio receivers and six outputs. This device was supposedly reading the person's mind. The research team was able to detect signals that would represent the comparable functions of the human mind. These were solid signals that would change with a person's thoughts that were coming out of the receivers. The device was actually reading the human's aura, which is a word physics and metaphysics uses to describe the electromagnetic field that surrounds the human body. The same way human speech is carried via radio waves, this device was carrying thoughts. The six output channels from the receivers would then run through a digital converter, turning them into a computer language, and then fed them into the computer. A Cray-1 computer was used to decode what the receivers were picking up. So again, it's like in the Matrix where they have these computers that convert what the information being put in and out of the Matrix is, and they could kind of read what's going on through the code.
Right. So
which is like,
They had to have something that could interpret this. You know, otherwise it's just...
Is this the Matrix? Is this what this is?
Are we in the Matrix?
Is this the Matrix?
Am I even here?
I'm coming to that conclusion.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm going to manifest myself a giant cheeseburger.
As a giant cheeseburger or a giant cheeseburger to eat?
Ooh.
Don't become a giant cheeseburger.
I can't. Yeah, make sure your thoughts are very clear.
Yeah.
So, from there, hard work and computer crunching was needed to get things to the point where the person would visualize something and a picture would appear on a computer monitor. Improvements and refinements continued until a 3D representation of the actual audiovisual aspect of the person's thoughts appeared on a computer monitor and could be printed. Again, like your brain is a organic 3D printer, and now your thoughts and whatever you were thinking could be physically printed out.
Right. I mean, your mind is a computer of sorts.
Right. Yeah. And you download information from the outside world.
Yeah.
And you process it. So when people at Montauk heard about the mind reading device, they thought it was great and they wanted to turn it into a transmitter. This could possibly cut the risks to humans undergoing invisibility or time experimentation. The theory was that the person in the chair would transmit an alternate reality to the crew, like in the Philadelphia experiment. When the ship became invisible, the crew would then be in sync with the alternate reality and wouldn't become disoriented or mentally lost.
So,
and that was like the big problem that they said that they were facing, is like these people would get stuck in this gray kind of area, right, and we didn't know how to get out of it.
So. Yeah. So this would give them that kind of
reference.
Yeah, that reference point, like that fake reality that they could at least feel like they weren't completely disoriented.
Right. At this point, the chair was procured, and it was now referred to as the Montauk chair. They now hooked up the chair to the coil set up from ITT. The Cray-1 computer was used to decode the transmissions being generated from the person in the chair. Then it was interfaced with an IBM 360 computer. This was then interfaced with a Montauk transmitter.
Whoa, man. That's some stuff there.
Are you guys keeping up? Because I'm barely. The extent of my computer skills, I mean, I played Oregon Trail and Mavis Beacon.
Oregon Trail is the best, though.
It was. They should bring it back.
Mm-hmm. I think they might have, but just,
ooh.
I don't know.
So around this time, Al Bielek took on a key role in the project. He is the author of the book, The Philadelphia Experiment and Other UFO Conspiracies, and has memories of being involved in the Rainbow Project as well.
So basically, it seems like if this is legit, you know, if it is or not, whatever, but if it is, then a lot of these same people seem to be involved in all, or at least quite a few of these projects, you know, like,
it's, yeah.
So, which I don't know. I don't know if that gives
like you... they kind of been shuffled around.
Right. And they have a certain skill set, you know, they have a particular skill set and they are using it and perhaps not fully remembering everything because of whatever is going on.
Exactly.
He was originally brought in to explain what was going on metaphysically with the use of the transmitter on the human beings. He was chosen because of his engineering background and the extensive knowledge he had of esoteric matters, which is just like matters that are not widely known. The researchers were getting tons of information from the Cray 1 computer that they didn't know what to do with, and it was this guy Al's job to begin to make sense of it. They had to convert what that Cray 1 computer was putting out so they could sync it with what the pulse modulation computer wanted, and the IBM 360 was eventually used as a translator. So the psychic would sit in a chair and think certain particular thoughts, and the Cray 1 would decode them, and then they would put those onto a 32-bit radio and put them into the IBM 360, and then the IBM 360 would then broadcast this out the transmitter. It was basically a thought form transmitted of what the person in the chair was thinking, essentially like a mind amplifier. So he would think something and it would be transmitted in broadcast. And yeah. It took them about 1 year before they had a signal that was actually readable. So after lots of work, they could finally get the psychic to concentrate on something, and the transmitter would send out a very clear representation of what he was thinking. And that was the first point in which the Montauk transmitter was working with high thought fidelity. So before this point, the chair had been at Brookhaven and was sending transmissions to Montauk, but they would encounter problems every so often when they thought that perhaps there was like a time glitch that had gone on, where if the flow of time glitched in any way, it would just completely screw up the transmission altogether.
So
I was not very knowledgeable about time glitches.
No, and that's like but it's like deja vu, like something happened and then it happens again and you experience that weird deja vu feeling. Like it could just be like a strange glitch in the
matrix of time.
Yep.
These glitches in time, I don't really know how to freaking explain them. Time is like a constant pulse and certain things can disrupt it. Certain phenomena somehow, and I don't know what they are, disrupt this constant pulse of time, and it ends up changing the direction, the speed, or the flow of time. And those are known as time glitches, and they may just be beyond me. These theoretically occur now and again, but since we are referenced in our reality, we don't notice them typically. But like Shai was just saying, perhaps that's what a deja vu actually is, and it is us recognizing that there was some glitch in time, and there was a, you know, we are able to kind of step out of our own reality for a second and realize, but not fully, obviously, because we still have no idea what they really are.
Right. Or it could just be a total brain fart.
Yeah. Or just like slipping. So with the chair being in the Southamptons and the people, the researchers being in Montauk, the experiments did not always work, and it was attributable to those time glitches. And it was imperative that they had to move that chair to Montauk in order to be able to continue on with their experiments without getting interrupted by time glitches. So it wasn't until they referenced the original prototype the chair was based off of, allegedly by those Sirians from the star system Sirius, and it wasn't identical to the one that ITT developed, as it had like different coils, and the coils were connected to crystals, which that's where I was like, what are you, like, come on.
Yeah.
Like, what are you talking about? the receivers were not actual electronic devices. They were crystals. So, but you know, what do we know? I guess is all I'm like, what do I really know? You know, maybe they were connected to crystals. So, they put out secret bids for this chair and for a new improved design of this chair, and RCA won the bid. And RCA was who Nikola Tesla had designed receivers for back in the 1930s. And their Tesla receivers had very special coil structures. They were normal radio coils, but they were arranged in strange coupling patterns as set up and designed by Tesla. I think we all know of Tesla.
Yeah.
And know that he had some serious scientific knowledge that was beyond his time, it seemed.
Just exploring that man's brain alone, the fact that he could just think these things and then make them become a reality, it's insane to think about. And it's kind of surprising that he wasn't honestly ever like kidnapped and his genius wasn't used for secret Nazi evil experiments.
So, So the setup of the new Montauk chair, they allowed them to create a constant field of energy within these coils, but it did not go outside of that. So it didn't affect anything outside of those coils. It just was able to really harness it inside, and that's where it stayed. And this is what was known as the Delta T that we mentioned earlier. So these coil structures could elicit like a change in time. So in 1976, the researchers got the final and the last generation of the Montauk chair. And by late 1977, the transmitter was reproducing thought forms without glitches and at a very high degree of fidelity. So at this point, the researchers kind of pulled out all the stops. They were ready to take this research to the next level. And they had this psychic, Duncan Cameron. They would have him concentrate on a solid object, and that solid object would actually begin to precipitate out of the ether. So whatever Duncan would visualize, the transmitter would then transmit the matrix for it and then build enough power to materialize whatever he was thinking of. There were times where it was like a see-through, kind of like a hologram almost, that would be kind of like a ghost.
But they were also saying, though, when watching interviews with him, he was saying, like, but they weren't just holograms. It wasn't just his mind projecting some false sense of reality. Like, if he wanted to, he could actually manifest 1800s Paris, France, and it would be this live physical time. And then, like, oh, like, okay, guy, but you know what I mean? But they were, like, convinced, like, this was the real deal.
Well, yeah, I mean, they said that he would also be able to materialize solid objects and even, like, a whole building, you know, like you just said, or, like, whatever. Like, he said if he thought about a building, it would appear on the base somewhere. So they had discovered pure creation out of thought with the use of this transmitter, supposedly. And after this was established, they wanted to see what they could do with this power, clearly. They were ready to get going on even more creepy stuff. So they began an experiment that they dubbed the Seeing Eye, which that name alone, I'm like, okay.
Saruman? Saruman?
Do what?
Lord of the Rings.
Oh, we're talking about nerds over here. And then I was just thinking the Whispering Eye from
God.
Okay. So they would give Duncan a lock of hair or some other similar item from an actual person, and they would have him concentrate on that person intensely while sitting in the chair. And he began to hone the ability to see through their eyes, to hear through their ears, to feel through their body, supposedly. And while that's pretty amazing, if that is true, it's here that the experiments begin to take on a more sinister agenda.
Oh, now it gets creepy sinister.
And that is where we are going to stop for today. Next episode is going to get real bizarre.
Yeah, it gets even more insane.
Well,
which will get you thinking
about
more hints.
Oh, yeah. What the answer is.
Yes.
So we thank you for tuning in and joining us. We are available for...
We're available.
If you want to email us your thoughts, opinions, suggestions, our email is creepitrealpod@gmail.com.
Constructive criticism, okay?
Yeah. You can find us on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher,
Podcast Addict, Buzzsprout.
Yeah. And if you could please give us some star, give us 5 stars.
Five stars
on iTunes. Any reviews that you could give us, that's super helpful in helping us reach new listeners. Again, welcome to all the new listeners that have been joining us over the past few weeks. Okay.
All right, y'all. We're out, and have a wonderful rest of your week.
Yep. We'll talk to you later. Creep it real.
Bye.
Bye.